Blog Talk Radio.
Well, here we go, ladies and gentlemen. We've had a couple weeks off, vacation, relaxation. I don't know, maybe some of these guys went to Cabo San Lucas. We'll find out. It's the Philadelphia Phillies Alumni Podcast, hosted by 1980s World Series champ Warren Brewster. Yours truly, Mark Mancini, producing this, and Todd Corder out there in Dixie. And we'll have a great guest here that we'll introduce as the drum roll will begin. 347-205-9631. You can catch the archive version on blogtalkradio.com/Mancini Sports. Podcast platforms powered by Mancini Media. So without further ado, it's more of him, less of us. As I lay the red carpet down, put the podium in its place, hand off the mic, Warren. First of all, how are you? Second of all, how can people get a hold of you? Third of all, what did you do for the 2 weeks, my good friend?
Good morning, Mark. Thank you for rolling out the red carpet to me. Yeah, everything was great. I can be reached at Brewster, B-R-U-S-S-T-A-R, at 40@gmail.com. And what I did for the last 2 weeks is just take care of things at home and work around the house, help my oldest son get some things together and go swimming and exercise. Youngest son went and played basketball with him and just had a great 2 weeks and enjoyed life.
Great. I'll turn it over to now Todd out there in Atlanta, and then we'll get into the introduction and the great guest we have today. And Todd, first of all, how are you? How can people get a hold of you? And can you put the sticky substance down? I'm going to start checking the Braves.
Hey, I had a great 2 weeks. My son graduated from high school. He'll be going in the Georgia Army National Guard on the 13th of July. He turned 18 yesterday. I had family in town from out of state. My wife was in town. It was a great 2 weeks. It went very fast. I saw a little bit of baseball, but of all the baseball I saw, the one that puzzled me the most, and I even saw Little League games for 2 weeks, but I never seen anybody ever miss first base like your Pittsburgh Pirates did. And, you know, I know that we won't miss first base here on the Philadelphia Phillies Alumni Podcast, the 1980 World Series champion Warren Brewster, and our guest today is Larry Shank, who's written several books regarding the Philadelphia Phillies and its illustrious history. He has been covering the Phillies since 1964. And as we bring Larry on, we're going to let Warren and Larry reminisce this morning because they go way back. We're going to let them go back in time, and then after that's done, Mark and I will go ahead and chime in on some other topics that are happening in Major League Baseball besides the sticky situation and, of course, your Pittsburgh Pirates. What is it? Missing first base and then also with two outs. Instead, the first baseman running down to try to tag somebody and didn't do it, just turn around and go back to first base to end the story. Something about first base in the Pittsburgh Pirates I just can't fathom. But I know here the Phillies wouldn't do that, and we wouldn't do that on the Philadelphia Phillies Alumni Podcast, which is with Warren Brewster and also sponsored by the Tug McGraw Foundation. Larry, thank you for joining us today. And I know you've touched first base. Mark's team hasn't touched first base yet, I don't think, even though that was one heck of a player in Hayes, Key Brian Hayes for the Pirates. And Larry, welcome to the podcast today.
Thank you. Glad to be here. Good to talk to you guys.
Great. So I'll let you, like I said, Mark and I will let you and Larry reminisce and talk about the good old days of the Philadelphia Phillies, and Mark and I will talk to you guys later on in the show.
Okay, perfect. Hi, Brewmaster.
How you doing, Baron? Great to hear from you.
I'm hanging in there.
Thank you very much
you?
For joining the show. Oh, I'm doing
my pleasure.
Same. Just having great time. Yeah, everything's good.
You're early in the morning. You're in California. You're early in the morning, aren't you?
Yes. Yeah, it's 8:30 in the morning here.
Yep. I thought you used to stay out at night all.
I know. Just getting in.
I thought you always say that late at night.
Yeah, I usually did.
Hey, we had a game with the Pirates, and I don't remember exactly what the year it was. I think you were with the team. McCarver was the catcher, and he had a grand slam in the Three River Stadium. And Maddox thought the ball was going to be caught. He was a base runner in first, so he went back to first, and Timmy passed him. So Timmy wound up with a single and one RBI, I think it was.
Right, right, exactly.
You remember that?
They called him out. Yes, very well, yes. Yeah, because Maddox, he went back to first to tag up, and Timmy passed him, yeah. And
that
was crazy. Yes, yep. Very, very well. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because we did have some late nights with the rain and playing on AstroTurf and being able to squeegee the turf and play. I can remember vividly playing a doubleheader against Montreal that lasted till about 3 o'clock in the morning, and then had a businessman special the next day because we were heading to Chicago to start a 4-game series in Chicago. So we played a lot of baseball in a 24-hour period.
Yeah, the AstroTurf allowed to do that.
Right, right, yeah, because there were a lot of times where regular fields were unplayable. Now they seem to have that issue with even grass is now out the window. They're able to clean, unless it's going to rain for the next 3 or 4 hours, they're able to fix the field and able to play even when it's a threat of rain.
We had Bill Giles was the executive vice president in charge of playing games back then. He always had that famous phrase, there's a window at the airport.
They used to hear that all the time.
Boa used to shout, we're not playing at the airport.
that was
a unique club, the 80 team. Wasn't it a unique club, really?
Yes, it was. Yeah, because it finally they started bringing some young players out of the organization, out of the minor league system, and filled in with all the veterans. You know, they had that core with Schmitty and Booney and Boa, you know, the main guys that were there for all through the minor league system.
Right.
And that's what I've mentioned many times on this show before. That's what it takes. It takes an organization to get a core of 4 or 5 guys that are the heart and soul of your team to be a contender, and then Paul Owens did a great job filling in whenever we needed a player. He filled in all the time. You know, he did a great job bringing in, you know, always at the trade deadline, bringing in somebody that was going to put us over the top. And I remember in 77, he brought in Bake McBride. 78, he brought in Dick Ruthven. You know, so there were always big trades made right at the trading deadline. And you know, that was the way the organization worked. It was a lot of teamwork. And then Dallas, when Dallas took over for Danny Ozark, that kind of to me, the one thing that got us over the top was when Pete got there.
We
struggled the first year he was there, but then in 1980, it made a big difference that Pete kept everybody motivated and hustle, and you know, and you loved, you know, I hated playing against him, and I loved playing with him. He was one of the greatest teammates I ever had. He was really fun to play with.
He had nicknames for everybody. You know, Boa was Pee Wee, right?
Yeah, right. Uh-huh.
Did he have a nickname for you?
I can't remember. Not that I'm aware of. Yeah, he called Dickie Pie Face. And called Schmitty Ahmad. I can't remember.
Right.
There was everybody had a nickname. Yeah, Pete was something else. He really he was the one that stirred the drink for us. He kept everybody going and you know, nose to the grindstone, because he was he was a very intense, most intense player I ever played with. He was just he was something else.
He could stretch a single into a double. He battled all the time. I remember the game in 81, which I guess it was yesterday in 81. We were playing the Astros at the Vet. He needed 2 hits to pass Stan Musial for the National League record. And we were playing the Astros, and Nolan Ryan was pitching for them. And for some reason, I was in the dugout standing behind the manager that day because Pete broke the record. We had Stan Musial there Greedy went first base. Well, the first time up, Pete got a base hit. All right, so now he needed one more hit. The next three times, which I was never in a dugout before, he had no chance against Nolan Ryan. Nolan struck him out three
times.
Not
too many people did.
No. So Pete tipped his cap to Nolan on the third strikeout. You know, he wasn't going to let Pete break the record against him. So he took some nasty calls and some heat. You know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was a phenomenal talent. Yeah, mm-hmm. that was the big thing in the 1980 playoffs when he took a lead into the seventh inning. It was something like 105-2 lifetime.
Right.
And we came back and tied it off him and then ended up beating him in extra innings. It was a team of destiny. You know, that team was we were going to win one way or the other. It was just a matter of how we're going to go about it, and it was it was amazing how we played down the stretch. I mean, we played starting in the middle of August. We started playing very well. I think we went like 35-7 something
like that. Yeah,
in August and September. And then it carried over into the playoffs. And then once we got past the playoffs, it was like everybody was relieved. And the World Series was just a matter of going out and having fun playing baseball. There was no pressure. We finally it was the pressure of getting past the playoffs that always caught up with us.
That was the most tense playoff series that ever was. I mean, there'd nothing been like that. You know, five games, extra innings.
Right.
Coming back,
right.
They came back. We came back. Trio threw a guy out of home plate. Relay in the Astrodome. A trio hit him, double down the third baseline. Didn't Greg Gross bunt against Nolan Ryan that night to start?
Right. Yeah. That loaded the bases, and then all hell broke loose after that. It was crazy. Yeah, I mean, it just Booney hit a ground ball back up the middle off him that he deflected, which if he had caught it, would have been a double play ball and out of the inning. It was, all sorts of things just happened to fall into place perfectly for the 1980 Phillies. You know, it was quite a ride. You know, it was a lot of excitement in that town. And to me, one of the most fun things was the parade. That parade was just phenomenal.
Incredible.
Incredible. Just it had been so many years since the Philadelphia fans had the Broad Street Bullies. They won the hockey championships, but they hadn't had any other championships to speak of in years since the 1960 Eagles, I think.
Yes, right.
So it was quite an experience for the town of Philadelphia, you know, and it was great to be a part of.
You know, that going down Broad Street, you couldn't see. It was just packed to people, and everybody was smiling, everybody wearing something red.
Yes.
You know, and then we get the JFK Stadium, and there's 100,000 people in there waiting for it.
Right.
That really blew my mind, you know.
Yeah.
And I was fortunate enough
to
be in the parade in 2008 when we won again, and that was impressive too. But there's nothing like the first one. I don't care what anybody can say.
Right.
The first one was just made you goosebumps. So.
Yeah,
were you sober during the parade?
No. No, they kept handing us beers. Once you ran out of one beer, they handed you another one. It was unbelievable. Yeah, it was a crazy time. And then Marty Bystrom, Dickie Knowles, and myself, we had to go to the bathroom. So a policeman took us down underneath the stands and said, here, just go right here. And it was boarded up with plywood, and all of a sudden people started breaking down the plywood and coming after us while we were standing there peeing. it was quite a time.
We solved that in 2008. We had a bus behind the players' platform, and there was a bathroom in the bus. There was also beer in the bus. So.
For
one reason or another, you had to go to the bus.
Yeah.
Now you were in the bullpen when Tug struck. You were in the bullpen when Tug struck out the last batter, right?
Right. Yes. Yeah. I came in from the bullpen.
What do you remember about coming in?
I was up throwing. Some of us, myself and I can't remember who else, but we were throwing, and it was like there's no way he's going to take Tug out of the game. So, I mean, it was like I'd throw a pitch and watch the game. Yeah, I mean, I knew I wasn't coming in unless something really drastic happened, and I'd have time to get ready. So, yeah, mm-hmm. So I was just standing there watching, and then just going out on the field, and then all the dogs and all the policemen to keep the fans off the field was just, you know, and allowing us to celebrate on the field was one of the first times I think that ever happened in baseball. Any celebration on the field with just the players only. Yeah.
I was in a lot.
And then when I turned.
Go ahead.
No, I was saying coming back, we went up in the locker room and then came back out on the field again.
Right.
To salute the fans and everything.
I was in a lot of meetings, World Series meetings with the network and police and city and all that. I never heard the word dogs and policemen. So that was a complete surprise to me when they on the field, and it created a buzz, but that's the way it was. And, you know, back then they gave you the trophy in the middle of the clubhouse. You know, remember you had a platform there?
Right.
You couldn't move in the clubhouse. I don't know who – everybody
was
in there. It's incredible. You know?
Right. And
Paul Owens
was
up on the stage.
Right.
Go ahead.
Ruley Carpenter. Yeah. And Dallas. Yeah, I remember seeing that. Yeah, I've seen a friend of mine sent me some of the films or all the playoff games and World Series and all the celebration and the parade and everything recently.
Mm-hmm.
So I've looked at some of those in the past 6 months to a year.
Go ahead.
Yeah, the one thing that, you know, I remember the most was just going out after the game and saluting the fans because nobody left the ballpark. Mm-hmm. Everybody was still there. Yeah, I mean, it was quite a night.
It was 11:29 p.m. I remember writing that down. That's when the game ended.
Yeah. Right.
And then
October 21st.
And then the next day we had the parade. And Slinky didn't go. Ron Reed didn't go. He went home to see his wife and daughters.
Right.
And that when we got the JFK, remember Tug said, what did Tug say? New York, take this and shove it or something like that?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Right. Right.
Did you think Tug was out of gas in that ninth inning that time?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Because he pitched, game four of the playoffs, I mean, it started way back in the playoffs. He pitched the first three games. And Dallas told us that he wasn't going to pitch in game four. Well, so he brought me in to pitch the ninth inning, and, of course, I walked the leadoff hitter, and then they sacrificed him to second, and then Terry Poole comes up.
Yeah.
And Terry Poole was a great left-handed line drive hitter, probably a 280, 290 lifetime hitter. And he came up, and I'm standing on the mound going, I've never got this guy out. And I'm going, I'm in trouble. And sure enough, he hits a line drive, ties the game, and that was the loudest noise I've ever heard in my life. Astrodome
was.
I mean, I was surprised the roof didn't come off. It was just the people were going nuts. And then, so now Poole's on first, and Enos Cabell comes up, and they hit and run with him. And he hits a little pop fly out to Bake out in right field. So I ran behind Pete going, I know. All I got to do is keep that ball out of the dugout. As long as the ball doesn't get away from Pete in the dugout, we're good.
Yeah.
And I look up, and Terry Poole's at shortstop, and he runs by me. He didn't go back and touch second and go back to first. He runs right through the middle of the infield. So he's going to be out one way or the other.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, so it was, And then we came back, scored him a run in the top of the 10th, and then Tug pitched the bottom of the 10th, and we won, and then he pitched again in game five. So he was running out of gas, and he pitched an incredible amount down the stretch in September. I think he gave up like one earned run in his last 30 innings. Just ridiculous.
Yeah.
You know, so that was where everything was pretty much centered around Tug in the coming down the stretch playoffs and World Series because he was on such a roll. You know, I mean, that's why the Phillies got him to begin with in 74. You know, and finally it took 6 years for it to come to fruition, but it finally paid off. Tug did a great job. But that's the way, back in those days, you didn't have a closer per se. The Phillies didn't. We just kind of went with a hot hand between Gene Garber, Ron Reed, Tug.
Yourself.
And, yeah, and they just kind of, we just kind of, you know, Danny went and Dallas went with the Hot Hands, and we went from there. And then we added Sauce, Kevin Sauchet, and Dickie Knowles to the bullpen in 80, in 79 and 80. And, you know, so they came in, and they were, you know, always had a hand in things. So it was, you know, we had a very, very strong bullpen, and that's, you know, the way the game's structured today. It's, you know,
huge.
We started seeing that in the late 70s, yeah.
Did you pitch 3 days in a row ever?
Oh, yeah, quite a few times, yeah.
But they don't do that anymore.
No, they watch. They have kick gloves on the pitchers today. They pitch an inning here, an inning there. There was I pitched a lot of times where they pinch hit for me. I'd come in and get finish an inning, and then there were other times. Well, we only had a four-man bullpen.
Yeah.
But with Lefty and Steve Carlton and Larry Christensen and Jim Lomborg, they generally went 7 to 9 innings every time out. So you only needed an inning or two out of the bullpen. It's not like it is today where the starters go 5 and maybe 6, you know, so you still need 4 or 5 innings out of or 3 or 4 innings out of the bullpen to finish games. We pitched an inning or two out of the bullpen every night, and that was about it. And then Lefty he went 9 innings almost every time out, unless they'd take him out if he had a big lead, something like that. But generally, he pitched the entire ballgame. And that was the way, well, I mean, that's the way we were taught in those days.
I think one of the most underrated pitch guys in the bullpen was Ron Reed, Slinky.
Oh, right.
He was durable. He pitched a lot. Never hurt. Either.
Right.
Never on the disabled list.
No.
Were you on the disabled
list? Pitched
multiple
innings. Yeah, I was in 79. I hurt my shoulder. My shoulder between 78 and 79. I missed the most of 79 and then came back.
You only pitched 13 games that year. So.
Right. And I pitched 12 of them in severe pain. I tried to pitch through it, and I just absolutely couldn't. I got healthy for one game in Chicago, and the next day Larry Bowe and Pete Rose used to go to the ballpark every day. So the next day we had a day off in St. Louis, and I went with them to play catch. I started to play catch. Oh, man, my arm hurts again. So I really struggled through 79. That was a very difficult year for me.
Yeah. I remember asking Johnny Padres, I said, when you pitched, I don't remember injuries like they have today. Of course, Johnny pitched back in the 50s, you know. I said,
right.
What's the difference? He said, we drank more beer.
yeah, Pods. I coached in the minor leagues for the Phillies for 6 years,
remember that,
99 to 2004. And he was around all the time. And he was the greatest pitching coach I was ever around. He could get the best out of every individual. He was just a phenomenal person.
Absolutely.
I love Johnny Padres.
Great.
Yeah. What a great man.
Who got the last out of the playoffs for us on the mound?
Dick Rufin. Against Houston? Yeah.
Yep, he jumped in
he
the air.
The last two innings. Right. We were out of pitchers. Right.
Maddox drove in the winning run and caught the last out.
Right, exactly. Yeah, little fly ball after right center field.
Where were you then?
Yeah.
I
pitched earlier in the game. In Houston, there was no bullpens. We just sat at the end of the bench because they had a great big, huge dugout in Houston.
Yes. Yeah.
Yes.
It did.
So we were always at the end of the bench. Yeah. And I pitched earlier in the game. I think I relieved Marty. I think I came in. Either Dickie did or I did. I can't remember which. I pitched earlier in the game in like the sixth or seventh inning. And that's another great story is Marty Bystrom coming down the stretch.
Five and oh in September.
And was not on the roster August 31st, which is a no-no. And Dallas petitioned to get him, saying that Nino Espinosa was hurt, so they switched Marty with Nino. And Dallas and Pope had, you know, they were fighting back and forth whether to let Marty pitch in September. And they gave him one start, and I believe he pitched 7 shutout. Well, I remember him pitching the first inning he pitched in Dodger Stadium. And he shattered, like, 2 bats out of the 3 hitters he faced. I remember Say just wood all over the infield when Ron Say hit hit a ball off Marty. And then he gave him a start against the Cardinals, and he pitched 7 shutout innings. And then 5 days later, he pitched against them again and pitched 7 more, if not all 9 against them. And then it came within like an inning or two of setting a rookie record for shutout innings coming to start a career.
Right.
And then gave up the home run. He gave up a home run to Dave Kingman in Chicago on a broken back home run to dead center field. Which is very rare. You don't see too many broken bat home runs.
No, not at all. Kingman could do it, though. He was tough.
Right, he was, a strong human being.
Which hitter gave you the most trouble, the guy you didn't want to face?
Oh, Keith Hernandez absolutely wore me out. I could not get him out. And we'd played against each other in the Bay Area. I grew up in Napa. In Northern California, and Keith grew up, I believe, in San Mateo, somewhere in the South Bay. And so we'd played against each other for years when in amateur leagues in California. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't get him out then either. I never got him out. The only time I'd get him out is if he hit a line drive at somebody.
You're not alone. Not many people got him out.
Oh, I know. Right. And he's a guy that's on the cusp of should have been in the Hall of Fame because he was the only first baseman in those days that could play defense. All the rest of the first basemen were basically DHs that couldn't throw anymore. Yeah.
Remember the play that the pop out that that Booney dropped in the dugout?
Right. Booney, yeah, that Booney, was that
Booney,
was
Booney said it's not – he shouldn't get blamed for it. He said, it was Pete's ball. He said it was the end of the dugout.
I
had a long way to go.
Right. Right. Yeah, so Booney just got an assist on it. Shoveled to Pete. Yeah, that was – if it hadn't been for that, we were in trouble because, like you said before, Tug was running out of gas. He was pitching on fumes. And but once he got the second out in that last out or the last man when he faced Willie Wilson, you could see the adrenaline kicking in. You know, it was once Pete caught that ball that popped out of Booney's glove, that was over. I knew that Willie Wilson didn't have a chance. That Tug would definitely the adrenaline would kick in and Tug just blew him away. Fastball right down, 85-mile-an-hour fastball right down the middle.
85-mile-an-hour fastball.
Yeah.
Are you big on radar guns?
No, because, it's – for me, my pitching was movement. I had to make the ball move. They hit the ball hard off me, but they just hit it right in the ground. Mm-hmm. So, if you have a guy like in today's game, like a guy like DeGrom that throws 100 miles an hour as a starting pitcher, I guess that would be important. But, it's location because that I watch games today. I have the baseball package. I watch baseball religiously. And you see guys throwing 95, 98 miles an hour, and they can't get big league hitters out because they have no command. They can't throw the ball to spot. They just throw it, and that drives me crazy that they can't get people out throwing that hard.
Command of pitchers have been replaced by power, and it's not good for the game. Location is it. It's like a pitcher is like a real estate salesman. Location is everything.
Right. Exactly. Yes, that's the
sinker ball, so you kept ball down the strike zone.
Right. Yeah, guys like me today they're no longer in the game. There's a few of them around, but they're far and few between now.
When you needed a strikeout, what pitch did you go to?
Usually sliders. So I could throw something off the plate. After I hurt my shoulder, 77 and 78, I could still throw my fastball and sinker and get it by people. But once I hurt my shoulder, I lost about 3 or 4 miles an hour in velocity. But more than anything, I lost some movement on it. So I couldn't use that. I used my sinker just to move people off the plate and then threw sliders. And then I learned a changeup. When I got traded to the Cubs, I developed a changeup. And that really made pitching fun. it was I had something to keep them off my fastball finally, and a pitch that I could use as a strikeout pitch. So I started striking people out, and that's when I really learned how to pitch.
Well, every pitcher and every hitter needs to make adjustments, right?
Right, right. Yeah, that's what that game is. The big leagues are – everybody gets there, but now it's how you're going to stay. And it's a game of adjustments, and the kids that can adjust stay, and the ones that can't are weeded out.
Yep. I heard somebody say that it's easier to get to the big leagues than it is to stay there.
Right, right. Yeah, it's difficult to stay, yeah, because it's a game of adjustments. If you can't adjust accordingly, then you get eliminated very, very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And for all the years that you were with the Phillies, Larry, now I know you're still involved with the Phillies. To what extent in what capacity do you work with the Phillies today?
Well, I'm officially retired. As of 2015, I got my last paycheck from the Phillies. I live in an independent living facility in suburban Philadelphia. However, Phillies are in my blood. That's all I know. That's what I spent 50 years with the Phillies. So I have my own Twitter. I write for the website, alumni stories, and try to keep my fingers in the game that way. My mind is still good. My fingers are still good. My legs aren't so good anymore. So.
Yeah. Tell me about it. Yeah, the physical, the mental part's fine. That's the physical part starting to go. Yes, I know the feeling.
I found out that senior citizen isn't for sissies.
No, so, you're exactly right. Yeah,
that's what it is. So, are you still coaching Napa Valley College?
Yeah, I still coach to stay involved in the game. You know, it's fun for me. I enjoy it. And what we do at the junior college. Two-year school, and we take kids, bring them in, and say, get the classwork, get in the classroom, get the work done in the classroom, and if you love baseball, we're going to move you to a four-year school. We'll find a fit for you with your talent, whatever level you can play at, and then we'll send you along, because our job is to get you to a four-year school and to get you a four-year education. Baseball is not going to last forever. And you get that four-year education, that's something that nobody can ever take away from you.
Yeah. By the way, I forgot to wish you happy birthday back in February.
Thanks, Larry.
So happy birthday. Any Thank players you. In the big leagues that started out with Napa Valley Junior College?
Yes, we did have one kid. In 2009, we had a kid named Tyler Cravey, and he pitched he got to the big leagues with Milwaukee, pitched like half a season with Milwaukee, and then was up and down the next year. Third year, he was up a couple weeks and then finally faded into pretty much oblivion and it's done with baseball.
Okay.
But we did have one, and I told the head coach the day I saw him. First time I saw him throwing a bullpen, I said, this kid's going to pitch in the big leagues. He had arms all the way down to his knees. He's tall, lanky, 6'4". And just a great athlete on top of it. Just he was our shortstop, three hitter, best pitcher. Just did it all. He was which was quite a talent.
What, were you a good hitter?
I was a terrible hitter. I couldn't hit at all. No, I couldn't hit a lick.
I knew that, but I didn't want to say that.
Yeah.
You're a 333 hitter, Brew. You're a 333 hitter. You had three hits in 9 years.
Right. Yes. Yeah, that's what I told people. I had a two-year hitting streak. I had a two-year hitting streak. I got a hit in 84 and another one in 85. Yes.
84 and 85, yeah. And the other hit came in 78 when you were a kid.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. When I was just a baby. Yeah. Off Donnie Moore. He jammed the piss out of me.
And you beat him up?
And – No, he jammed me, and it went down the right field line down in the corner. So
yeah,
I go running around first base. Yeah, and I go running around first base, and Bill Buckner is playing first base at the time, so he's trailing me into second, and he's screaming at me the whole time. Bill and I went to high school together. He was two years ahead of me in high school, so he was giving me a hard time the whole way to second base.
That's a great story.
Yeah, it was pretty funny.
Okay.
Yeah,
here's
that was one thing. Okay.
Go ahead. You scored
Ron
one
Reed
run.
Told me, right.
Hey, guys, you're listening
career.
To – hey, everybody. I just wanted to let everybody know you're listening to the Philadelphia Phillies Alumni Podcast. Our guest today is Larry Shank, who covered the Philadelphia Phillies for 50 years. He is a huge part of Phillies war lore. He is with Warren Brewster here on the Philadelphia Phillies Alumni Podcast, sponsored by the Tug McGraw Foundation, 1980 World Series champion Warren Brewster, by the way. They are reminiscing about the good old days here with the Philadelphia Phillies, Todd Corder here in Atlanta, Mark Mancini out in Los Angeles. And, guys, if we may say, you know, if we can transition from the Phillies back then to the Philadelphia team today. Larry, if we can, may I start with you? We have about 23
sure.
minutes left in the show.
Okay.
Talk about today's club, the positives, the negatives, what you see so much different from today's game than when Warren played, and how it's covered differently than in today's era than it was when you covered the Phillies.
Well, yeah, it's so different. I mean, we're in Los Angeles to play the Dodgers starting Monday night for three nights, so we can see what we do out there against the great Dodgers. It's a different sport. It's a different organization. We were very much a family organization. You agree that, Brewster? Brew?
Oh, yes. Yeah, without question.
We were family.
Yeah, the Carpenters were.
And then now it's a big corporation, and it's just a different scenario. The Phillies thought they improved their bullpen. They had the worst bullpen I ever saw last year. It was unbelievable. They signed Realmuto to a big contract and Digger D.D. at the shortstop. And we expected that we would hit our way to some more wins because of the offense, and that has not happened. And we had a questionable defense, which is the worst defense I've ever seen. We make mistakes. We get mental mistakes that aren't in the box score because they're not listed as an error. But we don't run the bases well, and they specialize what Warren Brewster did as a hitter. Everybody strikes out. we're third in the league in strikeouts. I mean, we played 40 games, I think. We've had 21 times where we had 10 or more strikeouts in a game. And that's I'm old school, very old school. I'm analytics. I don't like the shift. I don't like this the pitch count and this radar gun because then it creates an issue. That geez, the guy lost 2 miles off his fastball in two innings. We got to get him out of there. Well, they don't learn to pitch, Brew. They don't learn to pitch.
Right. Exactly. Right. Right. And that was in the minor leagues. I was a starting pitcher, and that's when I learned how to pitch. Was pitching through the seventh, eighth, and ninth inning to finish games.
Right. Well, now in the minor leagues, they pitch five innings. They're programmed to pitch five innings. I mean, you have to develop physically and mentally to be a great pitcher and get through the seventh inning. But the analytics say you shouldn't go through the lineup after three times through the lineup. Well, tell that to Lefty. Tell that to Bob Gibson. Tell that to Sandy Koch. Tell Drysdale,
Right.
It's a different game, but, I don't know. I love baseball. I love the Phillies. The games are boring. There's no action.
Hey, Larry, you mentioned about they can't catch. I tell you what, it was hard to watch the Braves and Phillies game yesterday. I don't know if each of you gentlemen saw the game, Mark included. The extra innings about putting the runner on second base, and they asked Tom Glavine about it, and Tom Glavine said, let me get this straight. Tom Glavine said, I can throw a seven-inning no-hitter and not get credit for it. I can go out in the top of the 10th inning and there's a runner on second base. I didn't put that runner on second base, but that runner scored. It won't go against my ERA, but I get the loss. I shake my head. And I'm going, wow, he really gets it. I enjoyed watching Glavine pitch here in Atlanta. I've been here 31 years. I'm a native of Michigan. And, you're right. They can't catch. What was the kid yesterday? The Marchand, he let two balls go between his legs and he tried to backhand him. Now, of course, it's going 100 miles an hour in there. And when you guys mentioned he struck him out with an 85 mile an hour fastball, everybody's going, well, that's nothing today. But you mentioned it. It's about changing speeds. It's about location. It's not about the speed because everybody's back can catch up to him if it's in the zone. A great major league player, that is, not some ordinary Joe off the street. But you're right, the game has changed so much, and I gave those examples. What do you think of that, Larry, Warren? What do you think of that?
Go ahead, Warren.
Well, you know, the game's changed. It's the to me, the aluminum bat changed the game as far as my era is concerned, because I played against the wood bat, and I was taught in college how to pitch inside. And people don't pitch inside as much as they used to. You've got to throw it down and away now, because that's what it takes to get people off, to get people out with, that are swinging an aluminum bat. You jam them inside, and they dink it over the infield, and they get base hits with it. So the philosophy of pitching has changed, and now if you're going to pitch away, now you want a high velocity to throw the ball by people. A lot of four-seam riding the ball up and away. One of the guys that now lives in Napa Valley, Joe Blanton, who was with the Phillies, pitched, had a great career with the A's and the Phillies and then a number of other teams, told me when he was with the Dodgers, they told the pitchers to pitch upstairs. They wanted, because everybody was starting to launch angle and all that, and he said they were teaching them how to pitch up. They were going up in the zone instead of down in the zone. So the game has completely flip-flopped and totally changed.
Yeah, Bruin, if you were pitching today, you would throw a sinker for a strike down in the corner, come back with another sinker
right
down in the corner, and the next pitch is supposed to be a high fastball to strike the guy out. And that's
right.
That's not your strength. Yeah.
No, I couldn't do that. I didn't have the ability to do that. And that's what we were taught in the minor leagues, was if you got a guy, Bob Tiefenauer was our pitching instructor in the minor leagues,
yep.
And if a guy was a good hitter and you had him 0-2, you deserved to brush him back. You moved him back off the plate. You had to, because the hitters were so good that they could lean out over the plate and look for pitches. So you had to set up that 0-2 pitch, move him back off the plate, and then put him away with your next pitch. And I learned early in my career, if I threw that pitch up above the belt, I had a hard time with that next pitch. That's when I'd make a mistake with that fourth pitch. And so I learned to just move people, just keep the ball down and throw more on their thighs and knees and move them off the plate there and then make another pitch. I couldn't go upstairs. If I threw the ball above the thigh, the umpire gave me a new one. They didn't miss those. They hit those 9 miles. I learned that in a hurry.
Yeah, the catcher never got it, right?
No. Somebody in the left field stands got it.
Kurt Simmons, who pitched for the Phillies in the 50s and later on with the Cardinals and so forth, I think his career went into the 60s, said you have to pitch the ball down at the knees because the arms are attached at the shoulder. If your arms are
right
attached to the knees, then you throw them high, he said.
Right.
But it's there's so much, there's not much coaching anymore, in my opinion. I'm not around anymore because I can't, but we use driveline people in the minor leagues to teach pitching, and I just don't understand that. You know, these
right
are people that never
right
played professionally.
Right. Yeah, and now you're finding pitching, big league pitching coaches are real young. They're younger than some of the pitchers that they're coaching, and that they've
right
come out of high school level, college level. It's the game is just, it's totally changed. It's not how you worked your way up through the system to get there, just like you did as a player. You did the same thing as a coach. And now it's kind of changed, and everybody's gone to all these different drive line and different facilities to learn how to pitch and how to do the mechanics of pitching have kind of gone out the window, and they do it on certain ways and all sorts of crazy analytics, and it's but then they proved that the guys can do these different analytics, and they can pick up 3 to 5 miles an hour in velocity, and that's what everybody's looking for. They want to see 95 and above now.
Alvarado, who won the game yesterday because we came back to win, is 5-0 as a relief pitcher. He has 22 walks. And that kill you.
Anyway, right.
Todd, you and Mark are big fans of the games. What do you think of the shift?
Well, I think here's the deal. I think this all goes back to they're talking about the substance on the ball and everything. And my solution is you want to get whatever they do with the substance part, fine. The shift, my thing is I'll take an example of like Freddie Freeman. Freddie Freeman's hitting 225, whatever he's hitting. And a podcast partner of mine on another show goes, well, that's because they're shifting him. He's hitting into it. I said, well, do you know how to solve that? Have him bump the ball 5 or 6 times down the third baseline. That'll, A, improve his batting average, B, get him into scoring position, C, his team will score a run potentially, and D, they'll win the game. You do all this, it'll get rid of itself, and the shift will take care of itself and go away. So my second solution is to move the fences back. Move them back. These guys are bigger and stronger and faster than ever. And Warren will attest to that. Move the fences back. Raise the mound back to where it was in 68, and you're going to see a completely different game the way it's supposed to be played instead of station to station, base to base, no hit and run, no bunt, no squeeze, no sacrifice, or anything like that. We're seeing home run, a walk, or a strikeout. Mark, what is your answer to the shift?
I'm not a big fan of the shift, and like Larry was saying with the analytics, I'm not into that either. But here, I'm going to throw some other things to you guys. You know, when you look at this, I'm not a big Rob Manfred guy. I never was. I just don't think he's done much like you know, when you looked at, you know, Uberoth or Bowie Kuhn or guys like that ran the, you know, the big leagues. But, you know, what happened to the stolen base? What happened to the Bruce Sutter type or the Raleigh Fingers or the Goose Gossage that I grew up with? What happened to the flamethrowers of a Nolan Ryan or J.R. Richard? When you look at the rivalries, you know, we had a guy chime in with a question here, you know, the Pirates-Phillies or the Dodgers-Reds. Now you have a rivalry that might last a couple seasons, but nothing like those things. And those were dragged-down knockouts. I mean, Larry, you and, you know, Warren were right on the middle of that thing, seeing it, you know, with the Pirate-Philly wars back and forth. You throw the Expos in there. You know, but the Cardinals and Mets were not even in the equation back then. And then you had, you know, Whitey Herzog and the boys with the running Redbirds. So I think the game has changed to a point. And, you know, I always hear they're bigger, faster, stronger. But show me a guy that can get a ball completely out of a stadium like Willie Stargell or Greg Luzinski in the bull ring. You're not going to get guys like that. And everybody talks about Mike Trout. I'll take Pete Rose any day of the week.
Yeah. Well, it is different. I mean, the minor leagues, baseball's experimenting with some weird rules in the minor leagues. In AAA, they have larger bases to try and increase base stealing. In Clearwater Brew, the pitchers are limited how many times they can throw to first base, and they have to step off the rubber to be able to throw to first base. And that, I don't know. And they're also trying the automatic strike zone down there with cameras, you know, and the first couple games there were more walks than normal. There's a lot of gimmicks going on. To me, I hate to go back to the 80 team, Brew, but you guys, Boa and Trio and those guys, learned where to play certain hitters. They didn't have to look in the pocket. And that's gone. They're programmed. They don't make decisions. They don't study the game anymore. You know, when a Freeman comes to bat, hits a line drive to right fielder, and there's a fielder there 35 feet out in the outfield, that's wrong. I'm sorry. You know.
Right.
Make the infield.
Deserves a better fate. Yeah. But that's what, you know, that's what I was going to say was, you know, I was, when I was pitching, I lived with Larry Boa. I mean, he was the whole key for my success. And I could look at him and I'd point, take a couple steps to your right, and I'll cover the hole. I would face Davey Concepcion. I'd throw him sinker in, and he'd hit the ball in the same spot every single time. I'd throw sliders into Tim Raines, and he'd hit two hoppers to second base. I knew exactly where certain hitters hit the ball every single time. I knew right where they were going to hit the ball, the majority of the hitters. You know, the ones that I could get out. The ones I couldn't get out, there was just pick it up and throw it back into the infield.
Yeah. Well, not
hey,
only
you
that.
Guys, what did you think? Oh. I'm sorry, Mark. What did you guys think of my comments in terms of the shift and what I was saying? Because I think, like I said, you know, you put the fences back, you raise the mound, you bunt the ball, you force people to get away from the shift. I think the game would change. And all they're worried about this sticky stuff and the spin rate and all this other stuff. There's always been sticky stuff. Pitchers have always used something to get an advantage. Warren can attest to that. Hitters have always used something to get advantage of. To me, this stuff is all nonsense, and we just need to go back to playing the game the way it used to be. And I think by changing the fence and raising the mound and bunting the ball, we'll get rid of all this stuff, and we'll go back to playing normal baseball. What are your guys' thoughts on that?
Well, moving the fences back is you can't do that in some ballparks. You'd have to put a fence up higher. You know, Citizens Bank Park in Philadelphia, the fans are right on top of it, so you'd have to you'd have to raise the fence in the outfield to prevent home runs. You know, when Brew was pitching, he cheated because he took some Napa wine, put it on his fingers, and rubbed it in the rosin, and it became sticky, right?
Yeah. That's
he was
right.
Always licking his fingers because he had wine on his fingers.
That's right.
Well, I'll tell you. Yeah.
Did he ever pitch with wine? Did he pitch with any wine in him?
Right. Yeah, I'll tell you one thing. Yeah, Randy Lurch is convinced I was in Pittsburgh giving him a hard time when they clinched that playoff. Well, they clinched a division in Pittsburgh.
Right.
And Warren remembers it vividly. I think we beat you on that. It was Friday or Saturday, and then you guys came back and took the last game on us with Randy hitting two home runs against us.
Right.
Right.
Yep. The Blade.
Yeah.
Yeah, we won. We lost the doubleheader Friday night, and then came back and won Saturday.
You know.
Yeah. When you look at that. Yeah. When you see that. When you look at rivalries back then, and we were alluding to it earlier. You know, you might have a Dodger Padre. I'm not excited about a Red Sox Yankee one today, because you know it's not really a battle. It's not really a knockdown, drag out affair. I can remember the Dodgers-Reds going at it in the heyday, but where has the rivalry gone, and will we ever get it back to where it stays more consistent more than a couple seasons, guys?
I don't know that, because our rivalry with Pittsburgh was great for years, but then they changed the divisions. We see them six times, three in Pittsburgh, three in Philadelphia, you know, and they're 6 hours away. And it's tough to get a rival. And Bruce knows this, in Philadelphia, you don't like New York, whether it's the Yankees,
right,
the Knickerbockers, the Giants, or the Mets, or whatever the case. But, you know, that's a good rivalry, but I don't know. I mean, we and the Braves have been knocking each other around for the last 3 or 4 years, but it doesn't seem like a real bitter rivalry, does it? I mean, you're down in Atlanta, Todd. What does it seem like?
Atlanta and the Mets do not like each other. Atlanta sports is, to be honest with you, very jealous of New York sports history. It goes back to when the Yankees, the Braves were the so-called team of the 90s, and then New York went ahead and took that away with four championships. So, and the Braves only won one. So there's been an Atlanta New York jealousy here. So I do think that is a rivalry. If you go back to Atlanta, they don't like the Dodgers very well because the Dodgers own the Braves in earlier in the 70s and 80s and whatnot, but that rivalry has changed too now that they're in separate divisions. So I would say the Mets are Atlanta's biggest rival, and then maybe Philadelphia. But you're right, the game has changed. I mean, the Tigers, I mean, gosh, they used to have a big rivalry with Boston, New York, Toronto, Baltimore, not anymore. It just doesn't seem the same. They're playing the Twins, Kansas City, the Royals, and the White Sox. And to me, it's not the same.
Well, here's the problem. And you got the Dodgers and Giants out here. They're in the same state. They play each other 18 times a year. And like Larry said, Pittsburgh and Philly are 6 hours apart. They play six times a year. I don't understand how baseball can't get this right, because it kind of reminds me, and we can roll it out to the old hockey days when the Pittsburgh Penguins were in the division trying to create a rivalry with the Montreal Canadiens, L.A. Kings, and California Golden Seals or Rockies or something. It's crazy. I mean, you're going to have geographic locations to build rivalries. And I'm sure if we played Philly 18 times a year, there'd be a lot of people on that turnpike going back and forth.
I would think so. But it's the way it is. Everything in life has changed. Hershey bars used to be a nickel. They're not a nickel anymore. Brew didn't have gray hair at one time. So.
Yeah, right.
You know, I'd like to see Randy Lurch come back, you know, or be able to hit in his prime the way that some of these pitchers hit today. You know, I still think, you know, I mean, Randy was playing today and he was in his prime. He'd be able to catch up and hit the ball. I mean, you know, it's the game has changed. I still love it. I still like it. But I just think the style of play has got to change in order for the game to come back. Come back to be America's pastime, and that style needs to be, like I said earlier, putting it on the grass, putting it on the rug. You know, I mentioned about moving the fences back. In some stadiums you can't. Well, you know what? Maybe construction needs to be done. I don't know. Maybe they can raise the fence, like Larry said, put the fence up higher. You know, get creative. Detroit, they used to have it's still a massive outfield there at Comerica, but it was really a massive. Then they moved the fences in a little, and I'm like, oh man. I mean, I just want to see the game being played the way it's supposed to be played, and not station to station where you get a strikeout, a walk, or a home run.
Hey, Todd, Tanner from Edison, Jersey wants to chime in. He says, does any of these guys have them old bicentennial hats of 76 that the Phillies wore? Can't seem to find that hat. Maybe Warren or Larry has a connection on that.
I don't think they sell them. I think they might sell them at the ballpark store. I'm not sure about that. But the ones they were red with the white stripes around them, right?
Yeah, I remember. Yeah.
Right.
I think there was four teams in 76 that wore it. The Pirates continue to wear it, but the Phillies were one of them. The Cardinals and the Mets were the other ones. But, yeah, the Phillies had them white stripes. I remember those in the bicentennial year.
Larry, I've got to know, did you ever remember a Philly failing to touch first base on a home run? I don't remember a player missing first base. I've done a lot of baseball in Metro Atlanta. I mean, even 6-year-olds hit first base the most of the time. You know, I felt so sorry for that player because he's an excellent young player and he's one of the players that the Pirates have successfully developed in Key Brian Hayes.
Right.
But my goodness, you know, Mark does a podcast with Coach Brock. And oh my goodness, I just wish I could have been a fly on the wall. Did Tarek not notice he missed first? Did he say, hey, Keon, come back and touch it? Or was it just too late? I mean, you know, Mark, as a Pirates fan, do you get up in the morning and do you kiss your wife on the cheek and get to first base? I mean, I don't know, man. How do you Pirate fans deal with this stuff? I don't know.
Well, they're probably were people that didn't touch first base or players, but nobody knew about it. We didn't have podcasts back then.
At least we have two things in Pirate history. We had in 1976 John Candelari no-hit the Dodgers on Candy Night, and the Pirates have been a thorn in Baltimore's side in 71 and 79. So I don't think Pittsburghers are welcome in that city.
Mark, I was just done burping formula back then. I mean, that's a long time ago. I mean,
memories never die.
I we're almost done with the show. So, guys, what do we have left? Less than a minute, Mark?
Yeah, probably less than 30 seconds.
Okay. Well,
thank you very much for having me. So, appreciate it. You take care,
thank
everybody.
Thank you, Larry. I really appreciate you coming on the show. You did a great job. It was great to talk to you.
Same here, my friend. Take care now. Be well, everybody.
Thank you. Be well.
Thank you for coming on.
Larry Shank, our guest today on the Philadelphia Phillies Alumni Podcast, sponsored with 1980 World Series champion Warren Brewster, sponsored by the Tug McGraw Foundation. Till next week, I'm Todd Corder. He's Mark Mancini for Warren Brewster in Napa Valley. Have a great week, everybody.